Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:31 a.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. And today is May 20th. Tomorrow is moving day for me, so I think it might be too ambitious to think that I'll have a full couple of hours to do the long-term audio and video, because it takes about an hour to record and then it takes at least another 40 minutes to upload. And I think I will have a very disrupted schedule tomorrow. So I'm going to reverse the order and do the big picture long-term audio today and perhaps a shorter video tomorrow. And I thought we'd kick off with Bitcoin. I had a question about why I was so cautious and bearish about Bitcoin starting back in March. And I think it's a good teaching example. And since we haven't had a chart seminar for 18 months now, then I think perhaps a little refresher for subscribers might not be such a bad idea. And then, of course, we can think about the consistency of other trends and what we might anticipate going forward and where are we in the bigger cycle of things. And the first thing that is important about Bitcoin is that it is capable of spectacular moves, both up and down. Absolutely nothing has happened to question that that isn't the case. So we've had a significant drawdown. A 50% decline is a big decline by any stretch of the imagination. What I find interesting is that people are comparing the 30% decline that we had yesterday to other big declines. But Bitcoin is down well more than 50% from the peak put in April. When we look at the consistency of any trend, then there are a couple of things that are worth considering. The first is that trends tend to be rhythmic. So if one can discern what the rhythm of the trend is, then we can anticipate that that rhythm will repeat itself until something happens to change the rhythm of the market. So when we talk about the consistency of a trend, what we're really thinking about is the rhythm. So there are a couple of different things that contribute to how we can measure the rhythm of a trend. The first is time. So how long are the ranges? How long are the advances? The second is size. So how much does it pull back? And then where does it find support? And then we can think about how do these periods of quiet give way to exciting periods of time. So that's when breakouts occur. And all of those types of ways of looking at the price action contribute to a wider picture of how consistent the trend is. So Bitcoin had all of those factors. So we can go back, and I think it is appropriate to look at it on a log scale chart. And the reason is that the size of the moves are really quite extraordinary. But when we then just go back to the low in March of last year, we had the initial pop on the upside and a little range. And then we had another range. And then we had another range. And these ranges were all one above another. And the first three ranges were relatively similar sized as well. So rather than thinking about the absolute move, it's more appropriate often with Bitcoin to think about things in terms of percentage moves, because large numbers of retail investors become invested. They're not doing so on a leveraged basis. So that is an important factor. Then the next range in November was also relatively similar sized. Now, then we had a bigger reaction, but it was following an acceleration, and it was certainly a bigger one. So this was an inconsistency. It was the first inconsistency in the trend, because it was a bigger reaction following what had been four relatively similar sized moves. But the price around 30,000 held. And then the defining characteristic of the trend overall also held, because we had a very emphatic breakout to new highs. And it's worth considering that every time it broke out in the course of this entire bull market over the last year, then it has done so in an extremely emphatic fashion. So as long as it was doing that, where we had ranges, one above another, ranges that were reasonably similar sized and were completed with emphatic breakouts, then the trend was still consistent. And that was true until approximately the 12th or 13th of March, because then the breakout failed. So we should really zoom in and look at what happened next. It came right back down and tested at the $50,000 level, but that broke a midpoint danger line stop. Now, the only time a midpoint danger line stop is appropriate is in a very consistent staircase sequence uptrend, which is what we had. With one range above another, it looks like a stairs. So when the breakout fails, it tells us that something has definitely changed. In any kind of move on the upside, you get ranges, and ranges are explosions waiting to happen. So when you get a range, it's completed eventually with a breakout. And when that breakout succeeds, it means there's a vacuum of supply above the market. And a range will persist for as long as it takes that vacuum to in fact form. Now we can also think about the length of time that Bitcoin tends to range, because the last three ranges had been for about a month. So it was right on cue in the middle of March that it was due a breakout. And it was on the cusp of getting it. But a midpoint danger line stop is a way of participating in a consistent trend until it stops being consistent. So the stop is placed in the middle of the underlying range as soon as you get the breakout. If the breakout fails, well, then it might just pause in the region of the upper side of the range. But if it comes all the way back down into the middle of the range, well, then that's a big inconsistency, and it suggests that certainly something has changed. Well, it came down and just touched, it kissed that midpoint danger line stop. It would have triggered it if the stop was in place, but then it rebounded and got all the way back up to the highs, and of course, then a lot of bullish commentary came rushing out that this was a new up leg and this has just been a somewhat longer process of consolidation. And then anyone who looks at trends would have been thinking, well, golly, it still has the sequence of higher reaction lows. But then that breakout failed as well. And then it came all the way down from about 64,000 to under 50. So then it broke the sequence of lower rally highs. And this was a big reaction overall. So we had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We'd had two failed upside breaks. The size of the reactions had been getting bigger since the beginning of this year. Then we broke the uptrend overall. So we had the completing type 2 top formation. Then there was an upside key reversal. And it was a big emphatic pop on the upside back above 50,000. And that translated into an additional rally up towards 60. Then we got a lower high. And the price then halved from the $60,000 level until the low yesterday. And we've subsequently seen a short-term rebound. And now the price is pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, people do look at moving averages, so it might be worth considering that there are what are the moving averages that people look at? And one would be a 50-day moving average. And certainly we can see that people were certainly buying Bitcoin on the way up, and then the price started encountering resistance in the region of the 50-day moving average, so that was an additional warning. Then we can think about the 100-day moving average, and we can then think that the big upward dynamic that we had right there at the end of April was from the region of the 100-day moving average. Now we're starting to see that the 50-day is starting to come back down and potentially crossing over the 100-day. We haven't seen an instance like that in quite a while. In fact, we have to go all the way back into this period around here, where it was the 50-day falling through the 100-day. Of course, moving averages are most are trend smoothing devices, so they really are most useful when there's a trend. And particularly now, as we come out of this period where we're seeing successive moving averages offering support and then resistance, well, now we're in the region of the 200 day, so we're quite likely to see a little bit of pause and consolidation around this area. But it's going to be a lot more difficult to make money from Bitcoin going forward because we're in a much more difficult environment. And this, unfortunately, is where people who are new to technical analysis and chart reading make a slip up, because this looks like a completed top formation. Now, when we go back and think about everything that Bitcoin has done over the years, then there have been plenty of times when it has pulled back in a violent manner. But this looks extremely different to all of that in 2016 and 2017, because all of this was on the way up. And we had this succession of ranges, one above another. And they had all found support in the region of the 100-day moving average. So now we've had a much larger pullback. We've had it coming back, not quite towards the region of the previous peak, but we've had a big move nonetheless. And then I think it's also particularly relevant that people are looking at these kinds of pullbacks without considering that these were counter-trend rallies within a bear market that lasted for an entire year. The best time to buy Bitcoin is about a year before the halving, and the halving was in May of 2020. So that was when we had this base formation completed, in about a year ahead of the halving. So we're now a year on from the halving. It's potentially likely that we could be in for a much less exciting period of time in Bitcoin for at least the next year. And then, as we come back up towards the halving, well, it's about 18 months before the halving. The next halving is 3 years away, so Bitcoin will probably reach a significant low about 18 months from now. And that would suggest that we could be looking at the potential for Bitcoin to not come back to the 200-day moving average, but instead to come to the 1,000-day moving average. In fact, I can put that up by simply changing the chart to a weekly on Bloomberg. So when we then look at the 200-day moving average now, this would be 200 weeks, which is 1,000 days. Well, it's currently around 12,000. And I think that that is a reasonable target for where we might anticipate that Bitcoin will eventually bottom. But it may not bottom until at least a year and a half from now. So we've had a spectacular run on the upside, and at the moment we have to conclude that it's over. Even though we've had a spectacular rebound off the low yesterday, well, there is nothing consistent about this trend any longer. And it would really require a great deal of additional support building in order to, I think, cement the view that this was just a big correction in an ongoing bull market. Of course, in the last two big moves we've had, the price peaked in December, and we're currently in May. So that was certainly not the same as what we've seen in previous cycles, but there is no evidence to suggest that we're not still in a 4-year cycle for Bitcoin. And then, of course, we have Ethereum, and Ethereum prices halved over the course of the last 10 days, and they were well off the low yesterday and additionally positive in here today. We had a clear acceleration in the trend, but it's worth considering that we still have reasonably at least, the sequence of ranges one above another. We had a dip down into it, and anyone who had a stop certainly had it triggered. But If it can hold the low around 2000, that will be beneficial. The challenge for alternative assets or altcoins compared to Bitcoin is that Bitcoin's the heavyweight, and all of these other assets continue to act in a high beta manner. And we had a very good example of that occurring yesterday. Now, with that sort of primer in the consistency of trends, let's then look at some of the other trends that are outstanding. So the S&P 500 has been trending higher in a pretty consistent manner for the last decade. It has been punctuated along the way with medium-term corrections, and the most recent of those was in 2020, where we had a very significant drop on, and this price also found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. When we think about the outlook for secular bull markets, well, then I think it is really very clear that big markets like this, they tend to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we can look at the log scale chart for the S&P 500, and during these long trending phases, it has occasionally, and when I say occasionally, I mean that in the periods when it pulls back in a violent manner, about once every 4 or 5 years, it has tended to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we had that in 2011, again in 2016, again in 2019, and then again in 2020. And now we have a wide overextension, and the price is about as overextended relative to the 1,000-day moving average as it gets. And the only time we've seen an example of an overextension like we've seen now, compared to history, it was in 1987. So we have a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean right now, and it suggests that we're due some consolidation, but that it's still a big trend overall. When we think about the things that contribute to a top formation forming, well, the first is that you have to have a big bull market already. Well, we certainly have that, and valuations are at the higher side of the historical band, but that's really only relative to their own history. On a comparative basis, equities are still not expensive compared to bonds, because bonds have got such an extraordinary overvaluation that they make everything else look cheap. So we've had this very impressive move on the upside. One thing that is now, in terms of this consistency, we can then just zoom in on the last year. So we have little ranges, one above another, and this is another one of those ranges, and it is holding in the region of the upper side of the last one. So it's a consistent trend, it's a trend in motion, and as long as these little ranges follow one above another, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The kinds of things that would really stand out as top formation development would be when we start to see liquidity being curtailed, and we're starting to see some talk about how that might happen. We had a phenomenal amount of money printed in 2020, and the total assets of central banks went from about 20 trillion to 30 trillion in the space of little more than a year. The most important point right now is that this trend is still going up. So the Federal Reserve said in here this week that they are going to continue to buy $120 billion worth of mortgages and treasuries a month, and that they're not quite ready to taper. And there was some talk that they might want to see a lot more people back at work before they even begin to think about tapering. Well, that would suggest that we're still going to be in a liquid environment for the foreseeable future. We also have the twin deficit issue. So on a global basis, governments are now running approximately 800 billion in deficits. So we've definitely seen that in the space of just a couple of weeks, where more of these figures have been updated, then the deficit situation has begun to improve. But that's not really true in the USA. It might be true elsewhere. And the USA is running massive twin deficits. So these are significant challenges, because the early part of the bull market on Wall Street was predicated on a favorable interest rate differential, and then it was the interest rate, it was the strength of the currency, and then it was the relative growth of the US economy compared to other developed markets. And on top of that, then you had this phenomenal innovation sector, which has been dominating global indices. So those were very important factors, but they're all linked to low interest rates, just not quite as low as everywhere else. The dollar index, if we just simply think about the consistency that we've seen on the upside with Bitcoin and the consistency that we see still in the S&P 500, and then ask ourselves, is this chart trending or ranging? Well, it's clearly ranging. And then we can think about, well, what do we see here in terms of the range? Because we have failed upside breaks at the upper side and the lower side. And the most recent failed upside break was last year. And now we're in the region of the lower side of the range. And we've just seen it encounter resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now we can go back and think about, well, what does this look like over the very long term? Because the dollar index has got a lot of cyclicality. The cyclicality doesn't tend to get a great deal of attention because of the messy periods in between the trends. So we can think about the significant low that we had in 1978 and then the peak in 1985. So it's a 7-year advance. We have a significant low in 1992, and then we start to see that we had this loss of momentum, but the ultimate peak was in 2001. If we instead look at when the retest of the low occurred, well, then we're looking much more like a 7-year advance. We've also had the retest of the low in 2011 and the peak in 2016. It was 5 years. If we think about this as the peak, it was 9 years. So we've had a lengthy period of time when the dollar has done rather well, and it does tend to rally for about 7 years at a time. Then, of course, we have these declines. So we had the peak in 1985, and the low was in 1992, which was 7 years on the upside. We had the peak in 2001 and the low in 2008, 7 years on the downside. Well, if this is the peak in 2017, well, it means we're unlikely to see a low before 2024. But this is the dollar index. If we look at the longer term history, or whatever we can find for the Bloomberg dollar index, well, the peak was in 2020. So that would suggest that the dollar could potentially now trend lower for another 3 years and potentially another 6 years. So we're unlikely to see a significant low for the dollar until somewhere between 2024 and 2027. And we're really only at the beginning of a new bear market for the dollar. Now, let's go back and think about that longer-term chart of the S&P 500, because it looks fine on a local currency basis. If you're a euro investor, well, then the recent performance hasn't been nearly as compelling, and really since the 2017-18 period, it's been a much less consistent chart, where we have a lot of these ranges dipping back into one another. And now this recent pullback has been exaggerated. If you're a pound investor, well, obviously, you had the devaluation of the pound in 2016, and that would have flattered the performance. But now we're still in an uptrend overall. But from an Australian dollar perspective, we're still in an uptrend overall, but it's a choppy uptrend and also dipping back into these ranges. So what we have at the moment is an environment where the S&P 500 is still consistent, and it's reasonably consistent and trending higher in most developed market currencies. But then we can think about, well, if the dollar is only just beginning to underperform, well, that would suggest that the headwind from the dollar's weakness is going to be a challenge in terms of nominal price appreciation. Now, obviously, from the perspective of the S&P 500, it could also be somewhat beneficial from a nominal perspective, because for a domestic investor, there are large numbers of companies in the S&P 500 have earnings from overseas. It's about 40% of S&P earnings come from overseas, so that has the potential to flatter the performance in nominal terms. That's a domestic argument, though. It's not an international argument. Then, when we think about the outlook for other markets, well, the Euro Stoxx index has been going sideways for a profound amount of time. And it's another one of these examples where we have these extraordinarily lengthy ranges. So ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And the Euro Stoxx index has been going sideways for 21 years. So when it does break on the upside, well, it would be a symbol that we are back in a medium, if not secular, bull market. Now, sentiment towards Europe is pretty grim. There is this perception that Europe can't get its act together, and that it is only a matter of time before the Euro project disintegrates, and the lack of governance and democratic oversight, and the bureaucracy that is continuing to come out of Brussels. All of these factors are significant, but the stock market has probably priced all of that in. And then, when we think about the performance in dollars, well, in the dollar term, it's really just breaking out of this range. We're still a long way from pushing on to new all-time highs because of the lengthy period of ranging. But it is worth reminding ourselves that during this period, when the dollar was weak in the period up from 2002 to 2008, then from a US dollar investor's perspective, Europe did substantially better than a domestic investment in the US. And that is even further exaggerated if we include all of Europe and not simply the Eurozone. So then, with the Europe Stoxx 600, you get a lot more UK shares, Swiss and Swedish and Norwegian, Danish stocks coming into this index, and it has clearly outperformed as a result. Then, of course, we have the other point right now, that we have this migration go underway from growth to value. And I think this is still a very nascent trend. It's only just beginning. And we don't really have clear confirmation just yet that it is in fact a new trend. We've just had a reversion to the mean and a break back above that trend mean. When we think about value, well, I will come back to that one. I'm just looking for this one. I think it's interesting to look at the performance of the S&P 500 compared to the CRB Commodity Index. So we tend to see these significant peaks, at the major peaks for the stock market in 1929, 65, and 2000, and we're now at way higher peaks today. I think that's more a story of the fact that commodities are still quite cheap compared to what, particularly their inflation-adjusted returns, but and also that the S&P 500 is rather expensive. When we think about value, well, Europe is certainly being considered from a value perspective, and that's why it's starting to attract interest. We can also think about Japan, where we have had a very clear breakout. And I think this is a good example of what a first step above the base looks like. So the biggest consistency of this trend on the downside was that every time it got up towards 20,000, it failed and made a new low. And then that changed in 2015. It got up to test the 20,000 level and was pulling back, but it quickly found support and broke out. And subsequently, we had this volatile range that lasted for about 2.5 years and subsequently broke out. So now we're in a new secular bull market for Japan, and there is at least some evidence that prices are beginning to steady, and it's quite likely that we're going to see these prices take out the peak from 1989 and then probably considerably more than that before this secular bull market has been completed. When we think then about what does Japan's market look like from an international perspective? Well, we can think about the Eurozone, where a domestic investor is on the cusp now of pushing on to new high ground. But from an international investor's perspective, the Nikkei is already at new all-time highs from a euro perspective or a US dollar perspective. So that is also a testament to the relative strength of the Japanese yen over the last few years. So this doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation in the region of the all-time peaks for the Nikkei from an international investor's perspective. And it suggests that as we think about the outlook for the currency, well, the yen has been strengthening for the last 6 years, and it's now consolidating, or at least the dollar is consolidating in the region of the trend mean. But the yen has strengthened up a bit over the course of the last few weeks. Now, if the yen, if the, well, I should, based on this chart, if the dollar breaks on the upside, it will break that downtrend and it will signal a return to medium-term demand dominance. But the simple reality is that there is no country in the world today is printing more money than the USA is. And what we're seeing around the world are an increasing number of countries that are tapering their quantitative easing already. Canada has certainly been the first. In here today, we had South Africa saying that they're done with cutting interest rates and that the next move will be higher. And the South African rand continues to strengthen, and it is clearly now strengthening in a reasonable manner, which is approaching the peaks from early 2020, but it's a very consistent trend of recovery from the lows in 2020. So then the Johannesburg All Share is consolidating right now, and that's in a US dollar perspective. It's right in the region of its peaks. But if we look at it in local currency terms, well, we've already broken out. So this just looks like a little consolidation. I think we can just simply draw a conclusion here, and it's that the first portion of the secular bull market on Wall Street was driven by dollar strength. And it's likely that the second portion of this bull market on Wall Street will be driven by dollar weakness. And that dollar weakness is supporting the values of assets all over the world, but most particularly in the commodity complex. We can think about the raw industrial commodities, which has got a lot of back history. It's also an equal weighted index. We've had this very significant rally over the course of the last year. It's come all the way back up to test the highs from 2011. So we're very overbought in the short term. There is certainly potential that we could have some pause and consolidation. When we look at the iron ore price, the Qingdao imports price has begun to roll over, hasn't? I can never remember the ticker for the Singapore iron ore. And that is a futures price, and I'm afraid I'm going to I'll remember it eventually, but I know that the iron ore price is beginning to roll over. We've had lumber prices which rolled over, but they were limit up yesterday and then limit up again in here today, so certainly support coming through in the short term. On the one hand, we have supply bottlenecks as a result of the pandemic. And that is creating an incentive for new supply to come into the market. It's beginning to inhibit demand because prices are so high. But a lot of the lumber mills are reluctant to invest in new supply. They were chastened by the bear market that prevailed before the pandemic, and they don't want to make a mistake of oversupplying the market, so they'd much prefer to just pick up the margins. And that's an additional point that margins on the S&P 500 are at the highest they've been in an extraordinarily long time. So companies are doing well from this broad environment. But we can also think about acceleration being a trend ending. So the massive reaction against the prevailing trend is a type 2 top formation completion characteristic. Acceleration is a type 1 ending. It is this clear acceleration, and therefore it's an ending of undetermined duration because big trends will accelerate on a number of occasions. So copper has done phenomenally well. And over the course of the last year, it has had ranges one above another. And we're now seeing another one of those at the minimum. However, it is worth just looking at that longer term chart because it's been ranging now for a decade. And we're right in the region of the all-time peaks. So it wouldn't be at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we get a deeper process of consolidation. Now, one thing that I think was, or I think is, particularly relevant here is the big bull market off the lows in the early 2000s up to the peaks in 2011 was driven by Chinese demand. So China was the big consumer of all industrial resources as they industrialized and urbanized the economy in on a grand scale. And China represents a very significant continued source of demand. But it's unlikely to represent demand growth going forward. And that's really what the bear market was about. So we had the big pricing in of China between about 2001 and 2011, and then subsequently the pricing out of China as a growth driver. China's economy is now more services oriented, and it's certainly much more interested in developing services rather than building. Excuse me, I need to cough. So, therefore, China and their intentions to continue to build out are obviously going to have an impact on commodity demand. And if that were the only story, then this chart would be very important because we've got the credit impulse rolling over. And we can see that in China, they are looking at trying to curtail speculative activity, and house prices are ramping higher again. And a number of bigger companies are starting to go bust, and most recently, Huarong, which is a state-owned bad bank, is on the cusp of going bust. So we've had a meaningful run-up in commodities. We can also see that over the course of the last decade, then there has been a very tight correlation between China's credit impulse and the Bloomberg Commodity Index, and commodities have done phenomenally well. So if China were the only story, it would be a time to be really quite worried about commodities overall. But the reality is that China's not the only story. And the reason that copper is now at a new high is because there are new demand drivers. And the new demand drivers are certainly in the wider technology sector, most particularly in renewable energy and electric vehicles. So when we have AMD talking about a new super cycle in semiconductors, well, semiconductors are also a supply and elasticity market. The reality is that the new demand driver that has upset the balance of supply and demand within semiconductors is electric vehicles and the automotive sector. The two big trends in the auto sector are electrification and automation. But at the minimum, a lot more driver assist technologies are expected and are coming as standard in new vehicles. And that means that cars are turning into mobile computers and they need much more powerful chips in order to deliver. Then we have the fact that Intel has been able to achieve a new record in the size or the reduction of capacitor sizes. They haven't done a particularly good job in keeping up with manufacturing, but they're certainly still well ahead in terms of their innovation, and the share continues to range. So we're seeing that there will be a lot more demand for newer chips, faster chips, and more chips. And that means that the big companies like Taiwan Semiconductor and South Korean manufacturers like Samsung, well, they're going to be spending well in excess of $100 billion each by the end of this decade to upgrade their manufacturing capacity and also to build new manufacturing capacity. And that is aimed 100% at satisfying demand from the automotive sector and the continued demand from the consumer electronics sector. Obviously, consumer electronics were a phenomenal growth driver in 2020. We are not going to see the same quantity of growth coming through in 2021. It's virtually impossible for that to happen. On the one hand, it's impossible for the companies to manufacture enough, and on the other, there is unlikely to be the same demand for new laptops and mobile phones and other devices after people spent so much money on new devices last year. So that's very similar to the argument, the Y2K argument from the late 1990s. We can also think about the trend on Taiwan Semiconductor, which until approximately 2020 was really looking quite consistent. We had these ranges, one above another, and then the pace of the advance picked up, and we went into this very lengthy period of time where prices had a great deal of difficulty surmounting 45, And then in late 2019, it broke out, and then it really took off. So now we're moving into another one of these lengthier periods of ranging. It's quite likely that we're not going to see the same kind of acceleration in semiconductors in 2021 that we saw in 2020, even if they do demonstrate support now in the region of the 200-day moving average. When we think about the wider commodity complex, it really is about energy and batteries. And the demand for copper is likely to ramp higher, and it is not easy to greatly increase the supply of copper globally, so prices will have to rise. And that's also likely to be a push factor in developing wind farms. And the wind ETF found support this week in the region of the trend mean. And of course, then we have this extremely lengthy underlying base formation, and then the clear break on the upside. And this just looks like the first consolidation within this broader uptrend. If commodities are starting to turn and the value proposition is towards international equities versus the tech-focused U.S. markets, and then we can think about which of the markets are less risky. So one thing that I find rather interesting is that Eastern Europe is starting to pop on the upside. The Hungarian market has consolidated very nicely in the region of its previous peak and popped on the upside in here today. These are the countries that will continue to benefit from structural funds from the EU. They're also generally friendlier, although obviously not in the case of Poland towards Russia. The Russian ruble has at least steadied. So the kinds of funds that invest in Eastern Europe generally tend to have a large Russian weighting, and the CRTX index is now pushing back up towards the upper side of, or at least pushing through the 2000 level, which has been resistance since at least 2013. If commodities continue to do well, it's likely to be beneficial for all manner of commodity exports. Countries like Mexico are in an interesting position because they not only represent commodity exporters, but it's also got well, it has a large border with the USA and is a major manufacturing sector and likely to benefit from reshoring. So the Mexican index is now also in the region of its peak from earlier in, or at least late in the last decade. And the Mexican peso, which had been really quite particularly weak in 2020, has recouped the majority of its decline and is continuing to trend. So when we think about oil, there is a tendency to think that oil has to be a secular bull market if commodities are a secular bull market. And the reason for that is that oil and energy is integral to the production of every commodity. So the running argument would be, and because it was efficacious in the last bull market for commodities, is that you can't have a bull market in commodities without oil. And it was the big bull market in oil that drove the cost of production of everything else. But oil prices are facing some very significant secular headwinds. The most bullish thing is that the major oil companies are no longer investing in new supply. So, on the face of it, that should be bullish overall. And it will create a limited supply argument at some point in the future. And if all other factors were equal, then that would probably be enough to create a new bull market. But the trend of government intervention is towards supporting the enemies of oil consumption. So that is a significant headwind. Now, if we add on the price of carbon to the cost of oil, well, carbon emissions were well off their lows in here today. We had two significant days on the downside, the two biggest dynamics we've seen in at least the last 6 months, and a rebound in here today. So certainly we're starting to see some more risk-on activity starting to come back in with the rebound in Bitcoin, the rebound in lumber, and the rebound in carbon emissions. These are accelerated trends that had big declines this week and are starting to rebound. But this is a politically driven market in carbon emissions. The Europeans want the price at 100, so they want the price of carbon emissions to double from here. They're forcing their energy companies to embark on unproven business models to become utilities, and this is obviously something that is a significant challenge because, on the one hand, we're seeing that supply should be inhibited as less investment moves into oil, but at the same time, they are even more driven towards destroying demand. So it's likely that oil will range more than trend until we see a major new source of demand appear, and that does not look apparent. There is no shortage of oil. Everybody knows where to find it. It is only a question of the cost of extraction. So I don't think that oil prices are going to sustain a move below 40, but I think it will be exceedingly difficult for oil prices to sustain a move above 80, and we're going to have a lot of ranging in between. Then we can just simply think about the performance of the major energy companies. They were exceptionally oversold in 2020, and we've had a meaningful rebound. It's been one of the best performing sectors this year, and it's 100% off its lows, but it's now encountering resistance in the region of that overhead trading range. And that trading range extends from 2010 to 2019. So the 400 level is a meaningful area of resistance, and it looks likely that energy is going to be a difficult place to make money. So if oil prices are not going to trend higher, then how can you have a new secular bull market in commodities? And of course, it's all down to the carbon credits and regulation and the unwillingness of the producers to invest in additional new supply. And there was a quote from the CEO of Glencore a couple of weeks ago where he was saying that we would need copper prices at $15,000 a ton to represent the price at which they would invest significantly in new supply. So it's unlikely we're going to see a big surge in new supply of copper when it's really only around the 10,000 level right now. So they want prices to be 50% higher than they are today before we'll see a meaningful advance. So China's credit impulse is rolling over, and that is likely to contribute to at least some pause in consolidation. But the big difference between the industrial resources and oil is that there is a new big demand driver for copper, and it's from electric vehicles and wind turbines. And those are politically motivated, and they are going to have the benefit, those sectors will have the benefit of producing the metals to achieve the utopian ideals of a carbon-free economy. It might turn out to be the biggest boondoggle in history, but it is certainly the way that the the tone of rhetoric is moving from governments. And of course, there's a darn good reason why governments are so interested in promoting green energy. The solar sector has been pulling back rather violently now for most of this year, but it was in positive territory in here. So we're certainly starting to see today that some support is coming back into the sector. And governments absolutely need a new tax. They need a new source of tax that does not focus exclusively on consumers. Of course, any tax that is imposed upon the corporate sector will eventually find its way into higher consumer prices. And we can see that in gasoline. So if we simply look at the price of gasoline, it's, I think, not an exaggeration to say that prices are well below the peaks that we had back in 2008 and 2013. But if we look at the daily average price of gasoline in the USA, well, then it's marching higher. So we're really not all that far away from gasoline prices pushing up into the overhead range. It's at $3 a barrel now. The last time it was at those levels was in 2014. Oil prices today are around the $73 level, and the last time they were up into that $100 area was in 2014. So basically, we have an environment today where gasoline prices are trading around where they were 7 years ago, and oil is nowhere near that. And the difference between the two is in the refining margin and in the additional costs that are being imposed on the sector. Tesla was able to build its gigafactories by selling carbon credits, and it basically meant that the companies like GM and Ford funded their expansion because they had to buy those carbon credits. So that is exactly what is happening now with the oil market. Those oil companies are going to have to sell, they're going to have to buy carbon credits, and all those automotive companies are going to be selling them, those carbon credits, as they build more and more battery-driven cars. So it's quite likely we're going to have a commodity-led bull market, that the balance of payments for commodity exporters are going to improve, and that will then strengthen their currencies. So we have the Australian dollar, which is consolidating now between the highs in 2017 and 18 and the 200-day moving average, but it looks like a consistent trend on the upside, and it looks like we're going to see a break above the 80 cent level. The Australian stock market has been powering ahead with the technology sector, healthcare sector, and banks, and the resources sector has been a bit of a laggard for most of the last decade, but it is now starting to improve, although susceptible to some weakness in the short term. So I think we have some clear evidence here that we're in a benign economic environment overall. There is still lots of liquidity around, but that we're seeing a significant rotation away from assets where the currency is likely to depreciate and into assets where the currency is likely to appreciate. So that is also beneficial for Asia, and the Vietnamese market is continuing to push on the upside, and this looks like a significant breakout from an extraordinarily lengthy period where it hasn't been able to push up and out to new high ground. It's worth reminding ourselves that in local currency terms it's at new all-time highs, but in US dollar terms we're still way below the peak in 2007 because of the dong's devaluation. The SET index in Thailand is also coming back up towards its peaks. It failed to sustain the breakout to new all-time highs in 2018, but there's the clear potential that it might be able to do that on this occasion. Of course, this is in local currency terms. And if we were to then translate that into what it looks like for an international investor, well, then we're still not breaking out to new high ground. So there has been a long period of time where Asian currencies have been underperforming, and it looks like it's over. So we've had a significant rebound in 2020, a bounce from the region of the trend mean, and it looks likely that Asian currencies are back on the front foot. It also looks likely that Latin American currencies are likely to do better, and they have fallen much more aggressively than Asian currencies, particularly the Brazilian real and the Mexican peso. If commodities do better, then that is likely to be broadly beneficial for all of Latin America, and they will be among the markets that should do best. The fact that Eastern European markets are turning to outperformance, particularly relative to Europe right now, that's also reflective of the fact that they're underowned. And that's also true of the Middle Eastern markets. So one would think that because of oil and the pressure that we're seeing on the oil markets, that they should be doing worse, but the Dubai market is firming from the region of the trend mean. These are completely underowned markets. They are starting to move to positions of outperformance, and they're difficult to invest in. There aren't easy ETFs to buy the Middle East or to buy the Eastern European countries. The EMEA sector has pretty much disappeared in terms of the broader market. A large number of those funds went bust. And we can think about that emerging Barings emerging market, EMEA. Our emerging EMEA sector has been going sideways now for 13 years. So as it comes up from the region of the trend mean, there's the potential that these markets will do better from here, as they all benefit from commodity price inflation and generally better growth overall. The inhibiting factor for a lot of markets has been the strength of the dollar over the course of the last 7 years. If that is in fact ending, it makes other assets much more attractive overall. And of course, that is the primary reason why gold remains on the front foot. If we're in a dollar devaluation environment and we're looking at the reality of financial repression, well, I'm sure veteran subscribers will remember the fears of financial repression back in 2001, 2, 3, and on to the peak in 2008. And we're in exactly the same situation now. We're likely to have an environment where we have negative real interest rates for the foreseeable future and clear demand for a hedge against the worst proclivities of government. Then, of course, this intention to increase carbon taxes and to find new sources of revenue, that's one of the big risks that are outstanding for Bitcoin, because there are a lot of people with significant profits in the sector that have been able to avoid taxation in one way or another, and taxing them because of their carbon footprint is, from the perspective of government, an elegant solution. And I think it's likely that that will be the case eventually. Then we can think about gold, that it's got an historic point or place within the financial architecture. It's less at risk from that kind of overt money grabbing or rent seeking activity from governments, at least as long as it hasn't already accelerated higher. But it is likely that we will have accelerations higher in gold. All of the gains in gold's bull markets tend to happen in short bursts, and we haven't had one in a while. We're still in this downtrend. The sequence of lower rally highs has not yet been broken, but the broad downtrend has been broken. We can clearly see that if one were to put in a trend line, it would have been broken by this move this week. So it's quite likely that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment for gold, and that gold shares are in a position to offer leverage to the gold price because the gold miners are not investing in new supply. They're more content to engage in M&A activity. In many respects, they have adopted the same business model that the pharmaceutical companies did with the biotech companies, that they're willing to take small positions in new mines, but not controlling interests until they have clear evidence that there is a viable structure, and then they'll buy out the smaller company. And that's exactly what the pharmaceutical business has been doing for years already. So I think this is an interesting area as well, because gold is comparatively underowned. We've really only just seen the breakout in the gold miners. This looks like a first step above the base. Silver looks identical, and it is a clear first step above the base. It continues to hold support in the region of the trend mean, and it is really quite likely that silver will be well in excess of the peak from back in 2011 before this bull market has run its course. And considering the fact that precious metals do generally do well when the dollar is trending downwards, and investors are worried about the purchasing power of their assets, of their fiat currency, well, that would suggest that we have a bull market that could last a decade in precious metals in front of us. I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.